welcome back to Kings of the Steam Age. With me is Anthony Dawson, who's going to put forward his candidate to be King of the Steam Age. Anthony, welcome back to the podcast.
Hello.
It's not surprising to anybody that you've chosen someone from the 19th century, since that's your area of expertise.
It's where I live.
Who have you put forward?
I've chosen Richard Peacock.
So not Stevenson.
No. Nope.
And not one of the very, very early pioneers, but not somebody who's an obvious choice. So Richard Peacock, 1820 to 1889. Could you sum up his career in 60 seconds?
He was the son of a mining engineer from Yorkshire, God's own county. One of his earliest memories was being taken to see the opening of the Stockton and Darlington Railway in 1825. He was apprenticed to the round foundry of Fentimore and Jackson in Leeds. His cohort whilst he was there included James Kitson, who went on to found Kitson & Company, David Joy, who developed the Jenny Lind locomotive and the Joy valve gear, and the Krupps brothers, when we know what they went on to do in Germany. His first job at the age of 18 was locomotive superintendent of the Leeds and Selby Railway. He said to the manager, "I can't do this job, I'm too young." But the manager said, "Actually, no, lad, we think you can do this." George Hudson came in and took over that line, and he scarpered. He disappeared off down to Swindon to be the personal assistant to Daniel Gooch for a few years. Apparently those two fell out, and he then scooted up back up north as the number one locomotive engine driver of what became the Great Central Railway. He was the locomotive superintendent of the Manchester, Sheffield and Lincolnshire Railway. He established the works at Gorton called Gorton Tank, where he laid them out, including the famous roundhouse and a model village. In 1854, he joined with Henry Robertson and Carl Friedrich Bayer to establish Bayer Peacock and Company in Gorton, which opened in 1855. He was the works manager and essentially travelling sales rep. He was, outside of engineering, he was a Unitarian and he practiced what he believed. So he established a mechanics institute, a penny savings bank. He paid for schools, a new church in Gorton. He was a Justice of the Peace, and he was the Liberal MP for Gorton until he died. And it's thanks to Richard's presence in the House of Parliament that the Act for the Manchester Ship Canal was passed.
That's pretty good. Well done. So let's jump back a bit to...
Born in 1820, first job, 1838. He was 18 years old, fresh out of his apprenticeship.
And then goes on to be locomotive superintendent, aged 18.
His first job after leaving his apprenticeship was to be locomotive superintendent of the Leeds and Selby, aged 18.
Which he attempted to decline.
Yes, because he said he was too young.
There's a quote from his obituary that I've got here. He's declining because he anticipates the difficulty in managing a body of men. And Mr. Clark says, "Can you manage the work?" He says, "Yes." He says, "Well, if you undertake that, I'll see to the other part," which is incredible for, you know, you don't really think that about 19th century businesses, which in my mind are quite cutthroat and that kind of thing. It's every kid's dream, really, who's into engineering.
But if you look at the career of someone else in that position, they'd have had to work the way up. He just went straight in with a top job as locomotive superintendent, equivalent of being chief mechanical engineer of what was a second mainline railway, the first mainline railway in Yorkshire, at the age of 18. It's incredible.
So we can say he's precocious.
Yes, and talented.
When that line gets taken over, he moves to Swindon.
Yeah.
Where he... Does he know Brunel there?
We don't know, but he worked with Gooch very closely. He managed the locomotive crews for the Great Western and was one of the men, along with Gooch, who tried to keep those weird, peculiar locomotives that Brunel had ordered going. The impression one gets of Richard, he was a brilliant people person and manager.
Hence his role in, well, selling Bayer Peacock.
Selling Bayer Peacock to the world.
Yeah. So he has a few other jobs, and then he moves from mainline to private enterprise in 1853?
Yes.
Because this is quite interesting, because I think a lot of people would be putting up their favourite CMEs and things like that of the mainline railways. He's already done all that, and then he moves into the private industry.
Yeah.
What's your view on where he was at that point in his life?
He'd been a CME coming up to 20 years. He was looking for a new challenge, and I think he was also frustrated by the fact that both lines were buying in their locomotives. At that point, they weren't building them. They were going to other builders to build them, and I think he wanted... He had ideas of what a locomotive should be, and they very much chimed in with Bayer's ideas of having a standard product, a mass-produced locomotive, which could be tweaked to suit various roles. because if you look at the locomotives inherited in the Leeds and Selby, it was a complete ramshackle pile of rubbish. The Manchester, Sheffield and Lincolnshire were mostly Sharp Roberts locomotives, but different batches, different specifications. There was no standardisation, no interchangeability of parts. And so he and Bayer came up with this idea, let's make standard engines. Let's try something new.
Because obviously this is before Churchwood's influence on Swindon on standardisation.
Oh, yeah.
So he's way ahead of his time there.
Yeah. I mean, this is influence on the one hand from Sharp Roberts and Manchester, because they started producing standard locomotive designs. And you need to remember that both Sharp Roberts and Bayer Peacock were also producing machine tools. They were producing incredibly beautifully made, precision. They were building precision machine tools to build precision locomotives at a time when many locomotive builders were still pretty much in the blacksmith tradition, which meant you had a standard thread size. Mm. You had a standard bolt size. You had parts which you could swap between locomotive. And it's also interesting that it was Peacock who encouraged Whitworth to move his works to East Manchester in Openshaw, pretty much alongside Bayer Peacock.
Well, well.
So you had, in that part of East Manchester, Bayer Peacock, Whitworth's, and then you had John Ashbury, the Ashbury Carriage and Wagon Works, basically on a long line in East Manchester, with this heavy engineering.
So he sets up Bayer Peacock a stone's throw from the Manchester, Sheffield, Lincolnshire Railway Works.
Literally the opposite side of the main line.
Wow. Okay, so literally across the road.
Across the road, yeah. It had been something like 4 acres of strawberry fields. Not strawberry fields forever, obviously.
Not forever, until the works was built. No. I get the impression, though, that his technical achievements aren't the only reason that you've nominated Richard Peacock to be King of the Steam Age. It seems that he was a bloody good bloke. Can you tell me about his social impact?
I think he's one of those people I have a man crush on. Richard was this big, jovial bear of a man. He was someone who lit up a room, who was the life and soul of every party. But he was also someone who had a really strong social conscience. And that came out of his very strong Unitarian belief, which is why he established the Gorton and Openshaw Mechanics Institute, why he established a non-denominational school in Gorton. Because in the 19th century, schools were basically run by churches, and the majority run by the Church of England. So unless you were a member of the Church of England, you couldn't go to those schools. So Richard said, we're not having none of this. We'll have a school that is open to everybody, irrespective of their religious belief, and has no fees. So we'll open a free school to go to, and everybody can attend it. He established with the Unitarian minister in Gorton, George Henry Wells, a penny saving bank, really ahead of his time.
But what's a penny saving bank for the uninitiated?
Where you could open a bank account with only one old penny. Not quite tuppence a bag from Mary Poppins, but you could open a savings account as a working man with a penny. So for the first time, a working man could have a bank account and save their money rather than putting it in a sock under the bed. Mm-hmm. He paid for a baths in Gorton, because it's a time when people didn't have running water in their own home. Because a swimming bath in the 19th century just wasn't for recreation. It was where you literally went to have a wash. Mm. But and attached to it were a full laundry, because a lot of working people at home didn't have the facilities to do their own laundry. They didn't have something like a copper in the back kitchen, and they probably couldn't even afford the coal to fire it. So he said, right, we'll have a Gorton public bath where everybody can come, wash, swim, but also have a wash house so people can do their laundry. And of course, he paid for the complete rebuilding of the Unitarian Church in Gorton. The original chapel had been built in 1703 and was a bit dilapidated by the middle of the 19th century. So he spent equivalent of £12 million building Brookfield Church. It's this enormous Victorian Gothic pile. It's still there. It's a cathedral of a thing. And that was a church, again, at a time where there was something called pew rent, where if you went to church, you had to rent your pew. You had to pay for the pew you sat in. And that was how churches were funded. You bought your pew, you rented it every week. So Brookfield Church, place of worship with no pew rent, all sittings were free. And attached to that was a non-denominational day and Sunday school for everybody to attend.
Do you think that Peacock saw himself as the patriarch figure of his community, or do you think he did it for altruistic reasons? Was it because of his beliefs? Why do you think he did it? Was it because of his background?
I think it stems from his religious belief, as Unitarians believe passionately in equality, that there is that of God in all people, and therefore all people should be treated with equal dignity, worth and respect. This radical thing now, but even more radical in the middle of the 19th century.
So this isn't really like the same kind of thing as, say, George Pullman in the States, where he sees himself as the head of the community and everybody working under him. This is more trying to pull everybody up, I guess.
Yeah, literally helping everybody to better themselves. It also comes from his personal experience of having been an apprentice in an engineering works. So he understands the heavy work that goes on in a foundry. And when he was a justice of the peace in Gorton, it said of him whenever any of the Gorton foundrymen from Bio-Peacock were up before the bench for having consumed a little bit too much beer, he would let them off and pay the fine himself because he'd done that foundry work himself. He'd also been an engine driver. How many locomotive builders have been engine drivers on the footplate? Very few of them. You can't imagine someone like Francis Webb being an engine driver, or even someone like Nigel Gresley. They're from the wrong social class to do it. Mm. He was a dirty hand, sleeve-rolled-up practical mechanic. And that also feeds into the locomotive designs, with having comfortable locomotives with standard parts and a standard cab layout. I mean, the classic Bio-Peacock cab layout is based on Richard Peacock asking engineman, where do you want this stuff?
Actually paying attention to ergonomics rather than where it's easiest to be.
Making it user-friendly, yeah.
So in many ways, ahead of his time.
Yeah.
What about his working relationship with Bayer?
They were chalk and cheese. They were polar opposites.
So why did they decide to set up this business?
I think it's because they recognised the talents in each other that each man lacked. Bayer was a high Anglican, he was a high Tory. Recent research suggests he was a massive closet case, bless him. He was a German immigrant and he had that German/Protestant work ethic where everything was about work. He was ascetic, he literally self-flagellated. He lived to work, whereas Richard Peacock had the social skills. He had the man management skills. I can't imagine Charles Bayer being at all a hands-on manager or being at all a people person, to be honest.
How much of the designs that they put out were Peacock's work and how much were Bayer's work?
Bayer was their head designer. He was assisted first by the whole of the technical side of Bio-Peacock were Germans. So first by Hermann Jaeger and then Hermann Langer. But he did accept input from the end users, including from Sweden, from Gustav Theodor Steiler, with whom Bayer may or may not have had a relationship. And he also accepted feedback from Peacock as well. So whilst Bayer was a head designer, he did take on board feedback from the end user and feedback from his colleagues.
So Peacock tours the world trying to sell his products.
Yeah.
Why couldn't he crack the American market?
It was already too big.
In what sense?
There was no way that Bio-Peacock could compete with, say, Norris of Philadelphia or Baldwin. They were absolutely enormous. They were producing far higher quantity of locomotives than Bio-Peacock ever could do. They were producing their locomotives in a production, again, like Bio-Peacock, standard design, standard components. But American design practice was cheap and cheerful, basically parts picking from bins to assemble locomotives, where even though with Bio-Peacock it's all standard parts, it's all precision engineered, still a hand-finished, labour-intensive, expensive design compared to the American product. They just could not compete in that market, so they didn't.
In that sense, were they too late to the table?
Too late to the table and too small. I mean, but that said, Bio-Peacock turned out 8,000 locomotives.
It's no mean feat.
In just over 100 years. It's no mean feat, but it's no Norris, it's no Baldwin.
Okay. Was Peacock a workaholic? Was he able to balance work life? Was he part of a movement that encouraged an unhealthy work ethic, which I know is a criticism of a lot of 19th century engineers?
No, I think he could separate work and pleasure, whereas Bayer and the rest of the design team at Peacocks really couldn't. They were a bit like Robert Stevenson, Locke and Brunel. They worked themselves to death.
Was there a tension there because of that?
I think so, yeah. Bayer thought Peacock was work shy because he knew when it was the weekend and because he thought his business trips around the world were essentially going on his hollybobs, and that going to Denmark, Sweden, the Netherlands, Russia to drum up trade, but particularly to talk with the end user of Bayer Peacock products, it wasn't important. It wasn't hard work. But without the very hard work of Peacock touring the world, Bayer Peacock wouldn't have been a locomotive manufacturer to the world. And their design spread all across Europe, Scandinavia, in Russia and in Africa. And there's very few major locomotive builders who were able to have such a massive slice of the market.
Mm. And still designs, you know, surviving even as far away as Australia.
Yeah.
What about his involvement in establishing the Institute of Mechanical Engineers? How did that come about?
It all came about with an ad hoc meeting on the Lickey Incline in Gloucestershire. Because hitherto, the engineering establishment had been very much biased against those who got their hands dirty. It's all very much the Institute of Civil Engineers, with people like Thomas Telford involved in that, all drawing straight lines and a map with theodolites and whatnot. And to get on as an engineer, you had to be in the London establishment, you had to be a member of the civils. A younger generation of engineers had a problem with that, thinking we're not civil engineers, we're mechanical engineers, we believe we should have our own institution. So they had this meeting on the Lickey Incline, which said, right, we need our own institution.
When was this?
That was in 1847 on the Lickey Incline in Gloucestershire, the stupidly steep incline. A gathering of locomotive engineers got together and said that we need our own institution, we need to professionalise and represent our body. Charles Bayer became the vice president, and George Stevenson was elected the first president. Richard, of course, became a member of the institution as well.
Where did that lead to?
It led to mechanical engineers being taken more seriously, both as individuals and as a profession. It meant suddenly you had a group of well-respected, well-connected mechanical engineers who were all working together and were able to network and were able to say to the general public, to railway financiers, railway investors, we know what we're talking about, and we're able to say to the London establishment, particularly the Institute of Civil Engineers, we're as good as you. One only has to think of the conflict between poor old George Stevenson and the London establishment and the Institute of Civil Engineers, thinking, oh no, he's nobody, famously with Sir Humphrey Davy over the invention of the Davy lamp. Oh no, he possibly can't have invented it. He's a nobody, he works with his hands. Suddenly, for the mechanical engineers, for the grubby blokes with giant spanners, they have this professional body. It's almost like becoming a guild body, if that makes sense. They're saying, we're professionals, we know what we're doing.
This is actually reflected in Raising Steam by Terry Pratchett.
It is, isn't it?
I never realised that it was... Oh, yeah. Well, it's obviously based on fact.
Yeah.
To what extent did Peacock innovate, and to what extent did he improve what was already there?
In terms of management, I think he was quite innovative, simply because he had been a foundryman, he had been a locomotive driver, he knew what it was like at the hard physical end of things. And it said of Bayer Peacock, there was never a strike there because Richard Peacock, in a very real sense, was one of these open-door managers, not this type of 1980s yuppie type. I've always got an open door, you can come and speak to me, but I've got an open door, lad, come and have a word, if that makes sense. And then that was reflected in standard Bayer Peacock locomotive designs. The layout is standard, it just makes them more ergonomic, it makes them user-friendly, not just for the locomotive crews, but for the fitters and everybody else. And producing a standard design, which could be used in a variety of settings, or could be tweaked ever so slightly, was again quite different at a time when some railways, like the LBSCR, were producing a whole raft of...
Well, a loco for every job.
Highly specialised, locomotive for every job. In that way, he's presaging people like Churchwood, and he's reputing the philosophy of people like Gresley, who again is perpetuating the idea of having multiple lots of classes, highly specialised locomotive designs, built in small batches, whereas Peacock is saying, no, let's have big batches of identical designs with exchanged parts of designs that are standard designs. He's almost presaging Robert Riddles with BR standards or even Stanier, perhaps, with having standard go-anywhere locomotives. Peacock was also instrumental in establishing the Locomotive Manufacturers Association to protect the rights and the business of independent locomotive manufacturers. It came about as in the 1870s, the London and North Western Railway had started building locomotives for other companies, including the Lancashire and Yorkshire, which Peacock and others thought this is an unfair monopoly. So in 1875, Peacock called a meeting of all the major manufacturers, people like Sharp, Stewart, Hawthorne, Kitson, Fowler's, Vulcan Foundry, but not Stevenson's. Say, look, this isn't right. This is unfair on us. They put together a petition to Parliament to say, no, Francis Webb, you cannot make other engines for different firms. At that time, the LNWR wanted to merge with the Lankey, and Parliament said, no, that's an unfair monopoly. So Peacock was the first chair of the association. And what they did was defend the rights of the members of the association, but also they helped parcel out work rather like a workers' cooperative, particularly in the 1880s and the early 1890s, when there was a trade depression. What members of the association did was, if they had an order, one member had an order, say, 500 locomotives, and they had a bit of spare capacity, they would pass on that spare capacity to another firm which had no orders on its books. So they would spread out the orders to keep each other in operation, if that makes sense. So they were spreading the risk, but they were also helping to keep each of these independent manufacturers operating.
Is that why you see locomotives appearing in the same design, but different batches will come from different manufacturers more often?
Yes, and they were also helping to keep these companies profitable.
Because you could exploit that situation and you could try to run your rivals into the ground on the back of that.
Yeah. But instead, they all came together almost as this cooperative to help each other out.
Where can we see his legacy today?
I think one of his legacies is perhaps railway trade unionism, as he was a major supporter of the working man, both from his own personal experiences and through his religious belief and his liberal political outlook as well. In terms of his lasting legacy, particularly in Gorton today, you can't miss it. There's Brookfield Church in Gorton, this massive cathedral on the main road running through Gorton. Most people probably don't know it was built by Peacock or that he's buried there, but there's this enormous lump of masonry surviving in the townscape of Gorton. Absolutely fantastic building. And I think he'd also be slightly pleased with the fact that Gorton Hall, I mean, he never left his adopted community of Gorton. Bayer bought a massive 20-odd bedroom stately pile in Wales, Llantysilio Hall, and moved off to Wales to be the landed gentleman. Peacock stayed in Gorton Hall, living quite modestly, and after his death, it was demolished and replaced with fairly modest row of terrace houses. It's the ultimate
tribute to him.
Tribute, democratisation of Gorton Hall, if that makes sense.
Excellent. Well, we're coming to the end now. Could you finish up by summing up in 30 seconds why you think Richard Peacock should be king of the steam age?
He was a bloody good bloke. He practiced what he preached. He had excellent labour relations. And he was a man ahead of his time in believing in a standard locomotive, not just in a standard design capable of doing multiple tasks, but standard production and standard layout to make a user-friendly machine.
Anthony Dawson, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
And for putting forward your candidate, may he fare well. I hope to see you again soon.
Likewise.